Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the Book of Psalms, so grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McLarty.
Turn to Psalm 78. Sunday we sang a song, When Trials Come. And the last lyrics of that song, read it for us, Jeff.
Sure. One day all things will be made new. I see the hope you called me to. And in your kingdom paved with gold, I'll praise your faithfulness of old.
And in your kingdom paved with gold, I will praise your faithfulness of old. That's really what this psalm is about. There are two big themes to Psalm 78. The one theme is that God expected Israel and his people down through the ages to remember him, to remember what he did, to remember his works of old. And for the Israelites, for the people that this psalm was originally written to, the big event that they were called to remember was their deliverance out of Egypt, their time through the desert when God gave them water from a rock and gave them bread from heaven. And the most consistent reaction from them was faithlessness, despite the fact that they had seen all these great works of God. You would think that anybody in their right mind, having seen God separate the Red Sea so that you could walk over on dry land, and then that cloud that he was keeping the Egyptian armies back with, and God drowned them all in the Red Sea, you would think somebody seeing that would go, oh yeah, that's our God. Oh yeah, he's for us. He's good. But then they get out into the wilderness and right away start complaining. They say, oh, did you bring us out here to kill us with thirst? Like that was God's master plan. Like, yes, I delivered you out of Egypt so I could bring you out here and not give you anything to drink. And then he gives them water from the rock. That's not enough. They start complaining about their food and thinking about how good they had it back in Egypt, like they were better off being slaves. God gives them manna, gives them food from heaven, bread from heaven every day except the Sabbath. And on the Sabbath day, the bread that they collected the day before would last for 2 days, whereas any other day of the week, it would grow moldy if they kept it more than a day. So it's like heavenly magic bread. It knows what day of the week it is. You would think that would be enough for them to say, well, oh, thank you. There's a million of us out here, and you're giving us bread every day from heaven. And they reach the point of saying, my soul loathes this light bread. They reach the point of saying, we've done everything we can do with it. We fried it. We baked it. We did everything we can. We made sandwiches with it. And I'm just tired of this light bread. And then they wanted meat to eat. And so God brings an east wind and brings quail into their camp. So many quail fall in their camp that they're 2 and 3 deep. And then as the children of Israel are eating the quail that God delivered to them, it says that even while it was in their teeth, God cursed them for their faithlessness against him. All of those events are going to come up in this psalm. The psalm begins by asking a riddle. Actually, the NASB renders it as, I will tell you a parable. But the word parable also means a proverb or a discourse. The riddle is, how could the children of Israel see these great works of God and still remain faithless? How could they continue to rebel against a God who made himself so obvious? And he wants us to consider that and think about it. And one of the things that you're going to see several times here is, think back on what God has already done. Remember what he has done. Remember the deliverance. Remember the Red Sea. Remember the water from the rock. Remember the bread from heaven. Remember all that stuff. And in fact, God was so set on the idea of Israel remembering year by year this deliverance that he instituted Passover. And every year at Passover, all the Israelites were required to come to Jerusalem and celebrate God's faithfulness to them, and they were required to remember what God has done. Then the church, as of Jesus sitting with his apostles and saying, "With great desire, I have desired to keep this Passover with you." And he changed their focus. He didn't say, "Stop remembering," but he said, "Instead of remembering your deliverance from Egypt, now remember what I've done and your deliverance from sin. But now do this, and do this every year. Do it. So that Paul would say, as often as you do it, you show the Lord's death until he comes. So it is a remembrance, because God wants his people to always remember what he has done. So whereas Israel for 14 years remembered God's deliverance out of Egypt, the church for the last 2,000 years has been remembering our deliverance from our sin debt through Jesus' finished work. But notice again the common theme, which is remember. And so the psalmist is going to say that he's going to recount these things because he wants his children to know it, and he wants his children's children to know it, and that every generation successively is supposed to pass on and tell the story of God's remarkable faithfulness to Israel, even to the point where in their rebellion, he remembers that they are just flesh, they are just human, the amount of pity that he takes on them. In fact, the language is, they're like a wind that just blows away. And so God continues being faithful to them despite their faithlessness and despite God's expectation that they will remember what he has done for them. And that is a riddle. Explain, people who can see that kind of faithfulness from God and yet be faithless in their rebellion against him. So, Psalm 78. The NASB adds a title. I wish that they had not. I would have preferred that they just left it at a maskil of Asaph. A maskil means, unlike some of the Psalms, which are meant to be musical and celebratory or meant to worship God in his temple, a maskil means, think about this, ponder this, really consider it. It's what's called a didactic psalm. It's meant to teach you something. It's meant for you to think about it. Listen, O my people, to my instruction. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth, and I will open my mouth in a parable, in a riddle, and I will utter dark sayings of old. The word dark sayings is actually kedah, which means a perplexing saying, an enigmatic saying, something that you have to really think about to make sense out of it. So listen to it, number one. Incline your ears to the word of my mouth. I'm going to give you instruction. I will open my mouth in this parable, in this discourse, this proverb, and I will utter these dark sayings, these perplexing questions. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and we have known, and our fathers have told us, and we will not conceal them from their children. In other words, he's saying, this was passed down to me by the ancients. This was passed down to me from the people who actually went through this. recognize that the deliverance out of Egypt was about 1400 BC. He's writing this apparently during the time of David, and the reason I say that is because it culminates in the kingship of David. So that's about 1000 BC. So we've got about a 400-year period that we're looking at in this psalm. And during that time, generation by generation, people have passed down the story of the deliverance of Israel out of Egypt. And so the psalmist Asaph is saying, I'm also going to recount that for you, and I won't conceal it from the children of those fathers, because generation by generation, we're supposed to know this. We're supposed to remember this. But I will tell to the generation to come the praises of Yahweh and his strength and his wondrous works that he has done. For he established a testimony in Jacob, and he appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers so that they would teach them to their children, that the generation to come might know, and even the children yet to be born would know, that they may arise and tell them to their children, that they should put their confidence in God. Okay, so he started with, remember, the forefathers told me, I'm telling you now, you're supposed to tell your children are supposed to remember it and tell their children, and the one thing they are supposed to remember, the one thing that needs to be repeated generation by generation is that they should have faith in Yahweh. They should put their confidence in the Elohim, in God. They should have complete confidence considering everything that God has already done for them. After all, they're in the land of Israel. After all, by the time he's writing this, David is their king, followed by Solomon, and they are a great and a powerful nation. This is before the Babylonian captivity. And they should be able to ask themselves, well, how did we get here? And they should know that by their own history. They should know that by passing the story on generation by generation so that they will remember the works of God. Do not forget the works of God. Pass it on to your children that they should put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments and not be like their fathers. Okay, that's part of the story, part of the remembrance of the fathers, is that when they came out of Egypt, they rebelled against God. And he's going to recount that now, the rebellions of the children of Israel as they were going through the wilderness, as they were marching through the desert for 40 years, as God was faithfully caring for them, and yet they rebelled against him. So don't be like that. Don't be like the fathers. They were a stubborn and a rebellious generation, a generation that did not prepare its heart and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Okay, so what actually happened? God delivered the children of Israel out of Egypt, brought them all the way to the edge of the promised land. They should have been brave enough to just go in and take the land. After all, this is the land that Abraham was promised. This was their land, and yet they were fearful. When they got to the edge of the land, they sent in spies to go see whether it was actually a land of milk and honey. Was it everything that they were promised? So they send in some spies, and the spies come back and say, it's a great land. Yes, flowing with milk and honey. Yes, it's a great land. But there were giants in the land, and we were like grasshoppers in their eyes. And they spread that fearful report through Israel that, yes, we're right here. Here's our land. God would have fought for them, but they saw the giants in the land, people that were bigger than them. And they said, we were like grasshoppers. We were just tiny compared to them, and so we're afraid. And for that, God made them walk through the desert for the next 40 years until the entire first generation of Israelites who came out of Egypt died in the wilderness, and only the second generation, people 20 years and under, got to actually enter the promised land with Joshua 40 years later. So right away it starts with, here it is, God is giving you exactly what he promised you. Here's the land that Abraham was promised in perpetuity. You're right here. It's here. Go look at it. Only two people said we should go take the land. That was Joshua and Caleb. They were the only two who said, yeah, we should go take it. God's with us. As a consequence, they were the only two that were spared from falling in the wilderness. So it was everybody under 20 plus Joshua and Caleb. He, God, established a testimony in Jacob. He appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should teach them to their children, that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they may arise and tell it to their children, that they should put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments and not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not prepare its heart and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Verse 9. The sons of Ephraim were archers, equipped with bows, and yet they turned back in the day of battle. Now, I will tell you right up front, I read many commentaries just about that verse, trying to figure out what particular event Asaph is referring to here. And there is no unanimity of thought. Depending on the commentator you read, they come up with different moments, different events. But the truth is, there's no historic event where Ephraim, as a particular tribe, turned its back. Yes, they were archers. Yes, they were skilled at archery, but we don't know the particular event that's being referred to here. For instance, in Keel's biblical commentary of the Old Testament, he writes, Psalm 78:9, which comes in now in the midst of this description, is awkward and unintelligible, because he simply doesn't know what that's referring to. In Barnes' notes, he writes, the children of Ephraim, the sons of Ephraim, that is the descendants of Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim. Ephraim was one of the largest of the tribes of Israel, and it was the chief tribe in the rebellion, and hence the term is often used to denote the whole of the 10 tribes, the kingdom of Israel, the northern tribes, in contradistinction from that of Judah. All of that is true. The northern tribes collectively came to be known as Ephraim, sometimes as Mount Ephraim. The word is evidently used in this sense here, not as denoting that one tribe only, but that tribe as the head of the revolting kingdom. Or in other words, the name is used as representing the kingdom of that name after the revolt. This verse evidently contains the gist or the main idea of the psalm, which is that Ephraim, or the 10 tribes collectively, had turned away from the worship of the true God, and that, in consequence of that apostasy, the government had been transferred to another tribe, the tribe of Judah. And the phrase, they turned back in the day of battle, means they did not stand by their brethren or assist them in defending their country. There is probably no reference here to any particular battle, but the idea is that in the wars of the nations, in those wars which were waged by national purposes, they refused to join with the tribe of Judah and Benjamin in defense of the lawful government. The only reason I read all that to you from Barnes is to say nobody knows the event that's being referred to here. And so he ends up kind of enlarging the concept and almost allegorizing it in order to say Ephraim, this reference to Ephraim, is a reference to all the northern tribes of Israel in their continuous rebellion against God. Either way, what we know is the psalmist started with that as an example of the faithlessness of Israel, despite the fact that God had already chosen them, had redeemed them, had taken them to Mount Sinai, had given them a law, gave them a testimony, and that they rebelled when it came time to protect and take their land. They forgot his deeds, says verse 11, and they forgot his miracles, which he had shown them. He wrought wonders before their fathers in the land of Egypt and in the field of Zoan. Zoan is the capital of the Hyksos rulers, or the shepherd kings. There are references in Genesis and Exodus to the land of Ramses, goes by the name Goshen. That was where Israel were encamped in Egypt. And so there were wonders that God did there in Goshen, there in the land of Zoan. Like, for instance, when God brought plagues on Egypt, like frogs or lice, that kind of stuff, or 3 days of darkness. When he did that, the land of Goshen had light and didn't have plagues. So God once again separated and understood the distinction between his enemies and his people. He has always shown that kind of electing grace where he protects his own even as he is punishing his enemies. The writer here, Asaph, zones right in on that as a demonstration of the fact that they forgot that he had wrought wonders before their fathers in the land of Egypt and in the field of Zoan. He divided the sea. That's the Red Sea parting. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through. And he made the waters stand up like a heap. And then he led them with the cloud by day and all the night with a light of fire. There was a pillar of the presence of God. One side of it was all cloud and darkness, and one side of it was all fire and light. And so, in order to separate the armies of Egypt from the children of Israel, that cloud descended between them and was a light to the Israelites so that they can see as they're passing through the Red Sea, but that cloud of darkness held back the Egyptian armies. Okay, so Asaph says, that's a pretty significant miracle. I mean, you should know your God is with you. If you can look up and see a pillar of fire that's protecting you, that seems like a clue. He divided the sea, he caused them to pass through, and he made the waters stand up like a heap, and then he led them with a cloud by day and all the night with a light of fire. He split rocks in the wilderness and gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths. In other words, so much water that it seemed endless. I don't know if you recall the story, but very briefly again, they're in a desert and they weren't able to find water. They came to an area called Rephidim and they complained against God. Moses goes to God. God says, go to the rock, which is really interesting language. And so God says, go to the rock, strike it, water will flow from it. So you're in a desert and there's a dead rock. There's no water coming out of that. If you don't think that is a significant miracle, go out there and hit some rocks and see if you can get any water out of them. So much water flows from this rock that the people are coming and watering their animals and their cattle and their family. They got so much water. Now, despite that, you may also recall that later on they did it again. They became thirsty again. And they came to Moses and they complained again. And Moses, he went to God and God said, go speak to the rock and water will come from the rock. Moses went, yelled at the people in his anger and said, hear you rebels! And he struck the rock a second time. And that was the one bit of rebellion from Moses that cost him the promised land. Because then in the New Testament, we read that that rock was Christ. So even back there in the desert, there is a typification, an emblem of Christ who is struck once and living water comes from it. And we, in order to receive that living water, we don't strike the rock. We don't re-crucify him, you Catholics. We don't re-crucify him. We speak to him. And we get that flowing, living water. So, this is again what the psalmist is bringing up. He led them with a cloud by day, and all the night with a light of fire, and he split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths. He brought forth streams also from the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. And yet they still continued to sin against him, to rebel against the Most High in the desert. And in their heart, they put God to the test, this time by asking food according to their desire. Then they spoke against God, and they said, "Can God prepare a table in the wilderness?" So they're out there in the desert, they're hungry, they forget about the whole water from a rock thing, and they start asking, well, really, how mighty is God? How powerful is God? Can he prepare a table for us out here in the wilderness so that we can have something to eat? That's almost mocking God, but it is certainly demonstrating their doubt that God is going to be able to provide for them. Verse 19, then they spoke against God and they said, "Can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rock so that waters gushed out. And streams were overflowing. But can he give us bread also? Will he provide food, meat for his people?" Therefore, Yahweh heard it and was full of wrath. And the fire was kindled against Jacob. And anger also mounted against Israel because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his deliverance, in his salvation. Yet he commanded the clouds above and opened the doors of heaven, and he rained down manna upon them to eat. Let's see how many of you remember older teaching. What does manna mean?
What is it?
They walk out one day and there's bread coming down from heaven. The dew on the ground, as the dew dried up, there was bread there. And so they said, what is this? And then it got the name, what is this? But he gave them bread, heavenly bread, every day. He gave them food from heaven. Man did not eat the bread of angels. Instead, he sent them this food, this manna in abundance. And he caused the east wind to blow in the heavens. And by his power, he directed the south wind. And when he rained meat upon them like the dust, even winged fowl like the sands of the seas, then he let them fall in the midst of the camp round about their dwellings. That's when he brought them meat, and even as it was in their teeth, he cursed them for their faithlessness. They ate, and they were filled, and their desire he gave to them. Before they had satisfied their desire, while that meat was still in their mouth, while their food was still in their mouths, the anger of God rose against them and killed some of their stoutest ones, some of their healthiest ones, some of their mighty and fighting men, and he subdued the choice men of Israel. And in spite of all this, they still sinned and did not believe in his wonderful works. So he brought their days to an end in futility and their years in sudden terror. That's the 40 years in the wilderness, and the first generation all died. when he killed them, when he brought about that previous judgment as they were eating the birds that he had brought to them, as they were eating the food that he was giving them, when he killed them, then they, the rest who were alive, then they sought him, and they returned, and they searched diligently for God. And they remembered that God was their rock, and the Most High God was their Redeemer. He had redeemed them out of Egypt. They remembered his redemptive work. But they deceived him with their mouth. They were lying. They were giving him lip service because they didn't want to die. And they saw how severe his judgment could be, but they deceived him with their mouth, and they lied to him with their tongue, for their heart was not steadfast toward him, nor were they faithful in his covenant with them. But he, this is astounding. Okay, let me back up for just a moment. I'm going to talk to you, Kenneth. Okay, so you got five boys. Okay, so when they rebel against you, are you likely to correct them in a, let's say, somewhat strict manner? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they probably deserve it every time you do, right? I mean, your son's looking at you like, yeah, that's right, Dad. Yeah, that's right. And you would think, after being corrected enough times, you would think they'd do better. But they don't. They keep going, and they keep going, and they keep rebelling, and they keep arguing with you, and they keep doing what they want to do despite you telling them not to do it. That happens. They're kids. They're rebels. And yet, you're their dad. You have compassion on them. And because you have compassion, you haven't eliminated them completely. And just know that's an option, okay? Because you have compassion on them. Look at the next verse. God, who is leading these people, feeding these people, giving them the desires of their heart, taking them to the promised land that he has promised to Abraham and his descendants. Despite that, they have rebelled and rebelled and rebelled. They have lied to him. They have said that they are going to turn toward him when they haven't. And nevertheless, look at verse 38. But he, God, being compassionate, forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. And often, he restrained his anger and did not arouse all of his wrath. Thus, he remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passes and does not return. Astounding grace in the midst of astounding rebellion. Okay, so what's the value of telling this story over and over? Not only are you going to be telling your children about God's great works, about his existence, about his miracles, about how he delivered us, not only are you supposed to do that, but as part of the story, they're also going to learn that God is compassionate and that he is gracious and that he is kind and that he forgives. It amazes me that these kinds of rebels could find compassion in the eyes of God. Now, God will say in other places that he didn't do it because of them. He did it for his own namesake. He did it as a demonstration of his own grace, of his own compassion. He was demonstrating the kind of God he is. He was demonstrating who he is and what he is like. And don't forget that these are the descendants of Abraham who have an unconditional promise from God that they are going to inherit that land. And therefore, he does not wipe them out because he remembers the covenant even when they don't. And he is going to deliver them into that land because he is a faithful God, faithful to his own promises, faithful to his own word, even to unfaithful people like us. Aren't you glad for that?
Amen.
Okay, so quick survey. Anybody in here ever rebel against God? Yeah, I saw several people drop their heads. Yeah, because you know that in this lifetime, Your fleshly, egocentric desires have kept you from being fully committed and fully trusting in God's faithfulness to provide for you, to take care of you, to get you through this life. They did the same, and it was only the compassion of God, the forgiveness of their iniquity that kept them from being completely destroyed, that God himself restrained his own anger and didn't arouse all of his wrath. And he does that because he has pity on us and because he remembers that we're just flesh. Verse 40. How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness, and they grieved him in the desert. Again and again, they tempted God. That means they put him on trial. And they pained the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power, the day when he redeemed them from the adversary, when he performed his signs, his miracles in Egypt, and his marvels in the field of Zoan, and turned their rivers, the Egyptian rivers, the Nile River, turned them to blood, and their streams so that they could not drink. That was one of the plagues that God absolutely performed in the book of Exodus. He made the river Nile blood. He sent among them swarms of flies which devoured them and bit them, and frogs, which destroyed them. He gave also their crops over to the grasshoppers, and the product of their labor was given over to the locusts. He destroyed their vines with hailstones. He destroyed their sycamore trees with frost. He gave over their cattle also to the hailstones, and their herds to bolts of lightning. He sent upon them his burning anger, his fury and indignation and trouble, a band of destroying angels. He leveled a path for his anger. He did not spare their soul from death, and he gave over their life to the plague and smote all the firstborn of Egypt, the first issue of their virility in the tents of Ham. But he led forth his own people like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. He led them safely so that they did not fear, but the sea engulfed their enemies. So he brought them to his holy land, to this hill country which his right hand had gained. He also drove out the nations before them and apportioned them an inheritance by measurement and made the tribes of Israel dwell in their tents. And yet they tempted and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies. They didn't follow after his law, but they turned back and they acted treacherously like their fathers had. And they turned aside like a treacherous bow. For they provoked him with their high places and aroused his jealousy with their graven images. When God heard, he was filled with wrath and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he abandoned the dwelling place at Shiloh, the tent which he had pitched among men, and gave up his strength to captivity. That's when the Philistines managed to capture the Ark of the Covenant. The writer of the Psalm says that even that was God abandoning Shiloh and letting himself be captured. And his strength was taken into captivity, and his glory was given into the hand of the adversary. He also delivered his people to the sword, and he was filled with wrath at his inheritance. Fire devoured his young men, and his virgins had no wedding songs, and his priests fell by the sword, and his widows could not weep. Do you remember the story of when the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant and they placed it before a statue of their god, Dagon? You remember what happened? They came in the next day to see Dagon standing over the ark, and instead, Dagon's head was chopped off and he was laying on the ground. God made even the idols bow to him. And they were quite anxious to get rid of that Ark of the Covenant and immediately contacted the Israelites and said, "We want to arrange to get this back to you." Notice it wasn't the Israelites who did that. It was God who did that. God continues to be faithful. Verse 65. Then the Lord awoke as if from a sleep. In other words, his anger was burning against them. And then once again, his compassion begins to rise. Like a warrior overcome by wine, where he had been in like a deep sleep. And then he's waking. He's remembering his people Israel. He drove his adversaries backward. And he put on them an everlasting reproach. And he also rejected the tent of Joseph and did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like the heights. What that's talking about is that originally when the 12 tribes had taken the land of Israel, the Ark of the Covenant did abide in that northern territory. But then God did not choose to remain there in Ephraim. He chose Judah. He chose Jerusalem. That's the place where he chose to place his name. That's where his temple was built. That's where his sacrifices and worship take place, because that's the place he chose. He chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth, which he founded forever. And he also chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds, from the care of the ewes and the suckling lambs. He brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. Remarkable, remarkable. I don't know if I can stress how remarkable that is, because this entire psalm, which is a lengthy psalm, 72 verses, this whole psalm has been about the faithlessness of Israel and God's faithfulness to his people because they are his inheritance. They belong to him. For years I've been saying, God will correct you. God will instruct you. God will pour out punishment, but he will always do it for the purpose of bringing you back to him. He will not lose you if indeed you are his. If he's in covenant with you, if he has written your name down in the Lamb's Book of Life, he's not going to lose you. He's not going to get the big eternal eraser and erase your name out of the Book of Life. He wrote your name down before the foundation of the world. It is fully his intention to save you. He sent his son to redeem you. And you are to go through your life telling the story of the great works of God. You are to remember and remember how he has brought you through every step of your life and how he has been faithful to you. And even in those times when we just naturally become fleshly and rebellious, we are nevertheless his. The same way that Israel was nevertheless his. And then, just to show his faithfulness to them, the culmination of this psalm is that God gave them a king after his own heart. King David. Who, if you remember the story, when Samuel came looking for a son of Jesse, Jesse brought his boys out in front of Samuel, and they were all tall, good-looking guys. And Jesse was sure that one of those was going to be the next king of Israel, and Samuel kept hearing God say, "Not him, not him, not him." Finally, Samuel says, "Don't you have another son somewhere?" And he says, "He's young, he's ruddy, he's out tending the sheep." And when Samuel lays his eyes on him, God says, "That's him." It was God who decided to make David the king. The shepherd boy became a king. And that's what's recounted for us here. He also chose David, his servant. And he took him from the sheepfolds, from the care of the ewes and the suckling lambs. He brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he, David, shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with his skillful hands. God is faithful to Israel despite their faithlessness, their rebellions, and their sinfulness. And I, for one, am just very happy that this Bible exists to tell me about the God who is willing to be gracious and kind and forgiving to rebels like me. This is very, very good news. And when you read that account that is in that psalm, you read about people who complained against God, who murmured against God, who were stiff-necked, who were hard-hearted, who were nevertheless the inheritance of God. And so, we have every confidence that if he has chosen us, if he has redeemed us, if his son died for us, despite our rebellions, he's going to remain faithful even in the midst of our rebellions and faithlessness. In other words, you're mighty saved. You're way, way, way saved. Because like always, it's God who does the good stuff. It's you who brings your sin, your rebellion, your fleshliness, your you-ness. You bring that to the table, and he brings all the magnificence of who he is, and he overwhelms you out of his magnificent grace. It's back in the Psalms. It's all the way through the New Testament. It's the only God you find in the Bible, and I, for one, bless that God.
Amen.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, Q&As, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.